And I said, "Are you bored with all this?" And he's like, "No, I'm not bored with all this. So if you guys aren't bored, I'm going to keep going. A lot of material here that we're talking about that I've never heard discussed. I've read it in books, etc., but I've never heard it talked about or brought forward in lesson format the way that we're trying to cover things here. So let's get going then with the introduction for lesson 158. The title is, for lesson 158, The Rules to be Observed in Translation. Since resuming class on Sunday, September 12th with lesson 151, we have focused on understanding the people and events that led to the decision to translate the King James Bible at Hampton Court in 1604. So far, that's been our focus. And then remember, guys, that like I got sick and took a trip and we had a conference, and so we got interrupted two or three times in there, and so it kind of took us a while to really get rolling. But thus far, we've observed the following. In lesson 151, we looked at establishing the pre-Jamesian historical context. In lesson 152, we looked at majesty, the king behind the King James Bible. We studied James, his personal life, etc. In lesson 153, we looked at assessing the contents and impact of the millenary petition. In 154, we looked at the Hampton Court Conference, historical significance, dates, and accounts. In 155, we looked at the Hampton Court Conference attendees, and we focused on the three big players, Reynolds, Bancroft, and King James. And then in 156, we looked at the Hampton Court Conference, the decision to translate. We looked at the precise moment in time when the idea was first floated by Reynolds for a new Bible. We looked at Bancroft's reaction. We looked at King James's reaction. And then we studied a lot of details regarding that. And then last Sunday in lesson 157, we looked at pre-Jamesian calls for a new translation. And then we also looked at the state of the English Bible in 1604. By making comparisons between the bishops, the Geneva, the King James, and modern versions. So we've done a lot of stuff already here as we started this term back in September. Today in lesson 158, we want to begin looking at preparatory steps that were taken before work on the new translation commenced. To that end, the next couple of lessons will be devoted to the following topics. We'll look at, number one, the rules to be observed in translation. We want to look at to what extent the rules were followed. And then we want to look at establishment of the translation companies and their assignments. So there's a lot of things that we want to talk about as we get rolling now with. So the decision has been made to translate. It was made at Hampton Court in 1604. Reynolds floats the idea. Bancroft says, no way. If every man had his humor, there'd be no end to translating. And then James steps to the fore and says, okay, we'll do it. In the words of Adam Nicholson, yes, I'll give you the opposite of what you want. And so the idea now is been accepted and proposed for a new Bible. And last Sunday we looked at calls for a new Bible before James. So what we want to focus on now is the details of how this project is going to be done. Okay, so look at the next point. The rules to be observed in translation. 2 weeks ago in lesson 156, we saw that Richard Bancroft, the Bishop of London, immediately objected to John Reynolds' request for a new translation of the Bible at Hampton Court. William Barlow, Sum and Substance, record Bancroft as having quipped the following, quote, "If every man's humor should be followed, there would be no end of translating." So did Bancroft want there to be a new Bible? No. Was he perfectly content with the Bishop's Bible? He didn't think there needed to be a new Bible, and that was his immediate response the moment that Reynolds floats the idea, as recorded by Barlow in the Sum and Substance. Okay? Ever the political strategist, despite being overruled by King James, Bancroft positioned himself to influence the process by laying the ground rules for the new Bible. Gordon Campbell comments on this in his 2011 book, Bible, The Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011. Quote, "Bancroft's objections to a new Bible had been overruled, but he was wily enough to ensure that if the project was to proceed, he would be a controlling hand in the selection of the translators and in the formation of the terms of reference that would guide their work." So Bancroft's initial reaction is, no way, we don't need that. But when the king overrules him, Bancroft is politically astute enough to position himself to be the one that is going to be one of the primary shapers of the project. Okay? In addition to providing preliminary source images from the British Museum, And by the way, I apologize. I had a book that I was going to bring, but with the holiday and everything, I left it at home. I forgot to bring it. I forgot to grab it. I was going to bring this book, Manifold Greatness, so I could show you the pictures of these actual documents. These pictures are under copyright. I cannot publicly access them to some of these manuscripts, so I was going to show you the pictures that were in a copyrighted book and just hold them up in front of the screen. I'm going to try to remember to do that next Sunday so that you guys can see the documents for yourselves. I thought about taking pictures out of the book and putting them in, and then I remembered a time when Cambridge University actually wrote me an email and threatened to sue the church because I put a copyrighted something on the church's website, which I immediately took down. So I didn't want to push the limits, okay? So in addition to providing primary source images from the British Museum, Manifold Greatness, The Making of the King James Bible, edited by Helen Moore and Julian Reed, states the following regarding the rules of translation, quote, "The translator's work was governed by a set of rules specifying how they should go about their task. These rules were drawn up by Bishop Richard Bancroft, ostensibly with input from the king. They survive in several manuscripts, for example, manuscript Harley 750 in the British Museum." That was the one I was going to show you a picture of, and I'll try to do that next time. "The rules address three main issues: the use of earlier translations of the Bible, the appearance and language of the new translation, and the organization of the company's work." So those are kind of the three general categories that the rules address. Again, that would be the use of earlier translations of the Bible, the appearance and language of the new translation, and the organization of the companies at work. Bible historian and collector Dr. Donald L. Brake also weighs in on the role of Richard Bancroft in setting up the project in his A Visual History of the King James Bible. He says, quote, "King James had appointed Richard Bancroft, then Bishop of London, to the Archbishop of Canterbury upon the death of Archbishop Whitgift in 1604. Bancroft was a staunch defender of the faith and especially tenacious supporter of the Anglican Church." So that's not new. We've seen that already. Bancroft was sort of the arch anti-Puritan, as we've already seen. His longstanding feud with the Puritans made him a natural choice to lead the translation process and suited him well to devise the overarching principles of translation. His 15 rules for translation, originally only 14, talk about more about that in a minute, clearly revealed bias against the Puritans and inevitably led to a translation that favored the Church of England. It is noteworthy that none of his principles suggest seeking an inerrant translation or even one dependent upon, should say the work of the Holy Spirit. Translators were simply charged with making a good English translation better by applying a mechanical and logical approach to their work. So, none of these guys, particularly Bancroft, who's devising the rules, he is not devising a project that he is seeking to, like, summon the Holy Spirit to guide or to somehow preside over. It's basically, here's the Bible, we're going to revise this Bible, here are the rules we're going to follow to revise this Bible. That's essentially as cut and dry as Bancroft's rules were. David Norton, the leading historian slash expert on the printed history of the King James Bible, offers the following perspective in The King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndal to Today. By the way, all these books I've referenced so far were all books that were printed 10 years ago in commemoration of the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. The ones by Brake, the ones by Campbell, the ones by Moore and Reed, and then this one here by Norton are all done to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the King James. So a ton of work was done 10 years ago on this. Norton says, quote, "The first steps were to choose the translators and draw up rules for the work, and to try to find money for the work since James didn't provide any." So James did not set aside funds to pay for this project. Okay, so Bancroft's going to have to figure out a way that this is going to get paid for, alright? Bancroft, on James's behalf, did most of this, but with little or no success on the financial side. 54 translators had been appointed and approved by James by the end of 1604. 14 rules were given to the translators, with a 15th added later, and a number of supplementary rules were reported to the Synod of Dort in 1618, presumably by Samuel Ward, okay? So, originally, there are 14 rules. A 15th rule is added later. And then we have a report, which we'll talk more about later, from Samuel Ward that he gave to the Synod of Dort in 1618, which is a retrospective account of what actually took place, which is important for us to consider, and we will do that in due time. All right, have more to say about these extra rules and Samuel Ward's report to the Synod of Dort in due time. Many presentations of the rules in academic groups and academic books group them together and comment upon them in chunks. Before we analyze and break them down, prudence dictates that we set forth all 14 rules in order as they appear in the extant manuscript witnesses, such as manuscript Harley 750 in the British Library. Please note that I've updated the spelling for ease of reading. So what we're going to do, folks, is we're going to go through the 14 rules exactly in the way they appear in manuscript Harley manuscript 750 in the British Museum. Okay, and I'm going to be probably leaving this here so that we can have reference to these rules throughout the lesson. Okay, so rule one. This is exactly the way they appear on this manuscript. Rule one. The only thing different is I've changed some spellings just to make it easier to read. I've just updated the spelling. The ordinary Bible read in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit. Okay? So I've said a lot about this. What is the base text going to be according to Rule 1? The Bishop's Bible. Okay? Number 2. The names of the prophets and the holy writers with the other names in the text to be retained as near as may be, according as they are vulgarly used. Now again there, vulgarly doesn't mean cursing and swearing. Vulgar there means common. Okay? So for example, I'm probably going to spell this wrong, but if you read your King James Bible sometimes in the New Testament, you'll see Isaiah spelled what? Isaiah. Okay? How would we spell it? That's the way we would spell it, right? So rule two said that they should use which spelling?
The more common
spelling. Yet we're gonna look at this in detail next week when we look at to what extent the rules were followed. Can we find examples of where the rules clearly weren't followed?
Yes.
Okay. So how many of you have seen the movie Pirates of the Caribbean? Okay, only two carnal people in here, and that's good. Okay. In that movie, they talk about the pirate code, and they say, well, it's really more a set of guidelines and rules. You know what I'm talking about? That's really the way these rules end up being, okay? They're not, and some people are going to write me and be mad that I compared the King James translators to the pirate code in Pirates of the Caribbean, but I'm trying to give you an illustration here, okay? So these end up being more guidelines than rules, and they're followed but not followed, and you understand, I'll have more to say about that as we go forward. So number one is to use the bishops. Number two is to use the vulgar spellings. Number three, the old ecclesiastical words to be kept, visa, the word church, not to be translated congregation. Now that's important, okay? Because that rule is favoring who? The Puritans or the Anglicans? That is favoring the Anglicans. They are instructed by Rule 3 to keep the ecclesiastical terminology. All right? Number 4. When a word hath diverse significations, that to be kept, which hath been most commonly used by most of the ancient fathers, being agreeable to the priority of the place and the analogy of the faith. So in other words, when they can, they're to keep terminology that is the ancient terminology used by who? The church fathers. Okay? More about that later. Number 5. The divisions of the chapters to be altered either not at all or as little as may be if necessity so required. So are they to keep the chapter and verse divisions that are found in the bishop's Bible unless there's a reason to change them? Okay. Number 6. No marginal notes at all to be affixed, but only for the explanation of the Hebrew or Greek words which cannot without some circumlocution so briefly and fitly be expressed in the text. So, are there going to be explanatory or commentary marginal notes?
No.
The only marginal notes, according to the rules will allow, are for the explanation of Hebrew and Greek words, not commentary or exposition on the text. You guys following this? Now, why would that be? What do you already know about King James that would lead you to realize that that would be a rule that he would want? What Bible did he not like? He did not like the Geneva Bible, and the big reason he didn't like it is because he thought the marginal notes were seditious, undermining divine right of kings, right? So is there going to be any stuff like that in a Bible sanctioned by the king? No. Number 7. Such quotations of places to be marginally set down as shall serve for the fit reference of one scripture to another. That essentially is cross-references. Okay, we'll talk again. We'll explain each one of these in more detail in a minute. Number 8. Every particular man of each company to take the same chapter or chapters, and having translated or amended them severally by himself, where he think good, all to meet together, confer what they have done, and agree for their parts what shall stand. Now think about what that rule is saying. That rule is saying that every guy, that rule is calling for every translator to individually, as an individual person, go through their assigned section, make any changes that they think need to be made, and then bring their changes to a meeting of all of the people that are in that company. That's what Rule 8 is claiming, or calling for. Okay? Number 9. Number 9. As many as any one company has dispatched any book in this manner, they shall send it to the rest to be considered seriously and judiciously, for His Majesty is very careful in this point. So when a company finished a given section, they were supposed to do what? Send it to the others according to this rule. Number 10. If any company, upon the review of the book so sent, doubt or differ upon any place, to send them word thereof, note the place, and withal send the reason. To which, if they consent not, the difference to be compounded at the general meeting, which is to be of the chief persons of each company when? At the end of the work. So you are seeing now the rules are calling for 3 stages here, essentially, right? Number 1 would be an individual review of the assigned section. Then the individual thing would go to a committee review of each individual in that group is going to come. And they're going to all talk about what they have. Then they're going to make changes. Then they're going to send those changes out. They're going to send their work out to the other companies to review. And then anything that was outstanding is going to be hashed out at the end of the work at this general meeting. Everybody following me? Okay? Page 4. Page 4. Number 11. When any place of especial obscurity is doubted of, letters to be directed by authority to send to any learned man in the land for his judgment of such a place. So if they really can't agree, what are they supposed to do? They're supposed to send it to other learned men in England for their what? For their input. Okay? Number 12. Letters to be sent from every bishop to the rest of his clergy, admonishing them of this translation in hand, and to move any change, as many skillful in tongues, and having taken pains in that kind, to send his particular observation to the company, either at Westminster, Cambridge, or what? So are all the bishops in the land going to be put on notification that this project is going on, and if they have any concerns, are they supposed to address their concerns to a particular company at Oxford, Cambridge, or Westminster? Okay? 13. The directors at each company to be the deans of Westminster and Chester for that place, and the king's professors in Hebrew and Greek in either university. Now, that is very specific language. These folks are ultimately going to be sort of answerable to who? The king. Number 13, the direct, I read that, 14. These translations to be used when they agree better with the text than the bishop's Bible, viz. Tyndale's, Matthew's, Coverdale's, Whitchurch's, Geneva. So, that rule 14 is saying that if they determine that the bishop's is not in agreement with the original, they should then consult what translations? Tyndale's, Matthew's, Coverdale's, Whitchurch's is the Great Bible. I'll say more about that in a minute, and the Geneva. Okay? David Norton notes the following. David Norton notes that the following 15th rule was added following uncertainty about rules 3 and 4. 15. Besides the said directors mentioned, 3 or 4 of the most ancient and grave divines in either of the universities not employed in the translating to be assigned by the vice chancellor upon conference with the rest of the heads to be overseers of the translations as well, Hebrew and Greek, for the better observation of the fourth rule above specified. So that's a little confusing. Let's look at what this says. Regarding this 15th rule, Bancroft wrote to the vice chancellor of Cambridge to explain, quote, "To be sure, if he had not signified unto them already, it was His Majesty's pleasure," there should be possessive S there on Majesty's pleasure, "that besides the learned persons employed with them for the Hebrew and Greek, there should be 3 or 4 of the most eminent and great divines of their university assigned by the vice chancellor upon conference with the rest of the heads to be overseers of the translations, as well Hebrew as Greek, for the better observation of the rules appointed by His Highness, and especially concerning the 3rd and 4th rule, and that when they had agreed upon the persons for that purpose, he prayed them to send him word thereof." So, I'll be honest with you, I'm not totally, it's a little bit obscure to history as to why they felt like adding this 15th rule was absolutely necessary, but we can only go by the facts that we have, that a 15th rule was added later on, and it seemed to have something to do with the faithful following of rules 4 and 5. Okay? So what did I say? What I mean to say? 3 and 4, sorry.
One question.
Yeah.
What is ancient grave divines? Is that a person's, I mean people, or is that text or what?
It's an old way of saying the church fathers.
Alive or dead?
Yes.
Okay.
It could be used to refer to the dead church fathers. It could also be used, depending on the context, to refer to those alive in the Anglican Church at that time. So, yeah, I will agree that it's a little bit fuzzy on exactly. But it does seem to be, if you look at it again, there should be 3 or 4 of the most ancient grave divines of their university assigned. So that would tell me that that's talking about guys who were alive at this time. So it could be referring to dead guys. Of course, they're all dead now, but it could have been referring to dead guys. But in this usage, contextually, I would say it's referring to people that were alive at the time. Now, we don't talk this way anymore, right? I mean, if you use the term divine to refer to me, I'd probably smack you in the face, right? I mean, I'm a believer, I'm a saint of the Most High God, but that's not terminology that we would use now. It was common back then. Okay. According to Norton, quote, "the only evidence that this rule is followed is Thomas Bilson's referring to Reeves as, quote, one of the overseers of part of the New Testament being translated out of Greek." So, there's obviously a 15th rule. We have documentation of Bancroft writing to the Vice Chancellor of Cambridge about the rule, but as far as whether this rule is actually followed, there's really not a lot to go on. Except for this one statement by Bilson in a letter to Reeves talking about the overseers of the part of the New Testament being translated out of Greek. So we don't have a lot to go on. So we know it was added. We know why it was added, at least in principle. Whether or not it was followed with any sort of letter of the law, we're not sure. A report from the Synod of Dort from 1618 adds 3 more rules to the original list. Okay, now, understand what's going on here. Those 14 or 15 rules, those are drafted in when? 1604, right? What we're going to read about now is a report that was given to the Synod of Dort in 1618. So this report that's given by Samuel Ward is retrospective. It's looking back on the project after the project was what? Finished. Okay, now, I don't know what you've encountered in your professional life, but in my professional life, there's often been a project presented and they're like, well, we're gonna follow a procedure of A, B, and C as we work on this project. And you start out to work on the project with the intention of following A, B, and C, but you get into the project and you realize that C is irrelevant, that you don't need C, and so you don't what? You don't use C, right? So what's interesting about this account is that it's given in 1618 as a retrospective on what happened. All right, so let's look at this. So bottom of page 4. A report from the Synod of Dort in 1618 adds 3 more rules to the original list. Quote, that words with no extant equivalent in the original were to be marked by the use of small Roman type, or what we would call today what? Italics. Okay? So in other words, words that are provided by the translators to complete a thought in English that are not necessarily in the underlying Hebrew or Greek are going to be in italics, or what they call here small Roman type. What we would call what? Italics. So if you're reading in your King James Bible, will you find the use of italics even now? Okay? So let me start that over again. That words with no exact equivalent in the original were to be marked by the use of small Roman type. That new argument or summaries to each book and chapter summaries were to be supplied, and that a genealogy and a map of the Holy Land were to be included. So that's a report given in 1618 about some additional things that were added or included, or procedures that were followed that were not explicitly addressed in the original 14 or 15 rules. Okay? Now, do we know that they did follow this thing of using small Roman type? We know that. Do we still have italics in our King James Bibles today? Okay? So, any questions about the rules before we get into the next point about an explanation of the rules?
The book and chapter summaries that were being supplied, was that like a commentary type thing?
So, good question. So, let's go look at a page. We'll just look at Genesis 1:1, and we want to look at this in the original 1611. Okay? So,
what that's talking about is this. So here's Genesis chapter 1 in the 1611, and here's a chapter summary at the beginning. So when in that last quote that we read, that's what that's talking about, is adding stuff like this. Here you can see some cross references. We're going to do a whole lesson on the marginal notes in the King James Bible at some point. We're not going to delve into that real detail right now. But when it's talking there about the use of italics, small Roman type, and stuff like that. So here's verse 2. And the earth was without form and void, and
darkness.
See how it's a different type? So what they're saying there is that is added in small Roman type to indicate that the word was is added to the English to make make sure that it's not, so that
it flows.
So it flows in English, even though the word was is not in the Hebrew in this case. So I'm curious. I didn't check this. Somebody open your King James and go to verse Genesis 1:2 and tell me if was is still in italics. I believe it is, but I would be just curious to know. So I'm looking for somebody to look at Genesis 1:2. Is it in italics?
It's not in italics. Oh, it's kind of sarai.
Okay, yours is in italics.
Yeah.
Italics. Will. Italics. Okay. So that's principle, right?
So what he's saying there, after the fact in the Synod of Dort from 1618, is that they did this. They added a chapter summary, and then they also used the small Roman type to indicate words, or what we would call italics. Okay? So you can see that if you actually look at a 1611. Whether it's in italics now?
Yeah.
Well, most, yeah, I mean, I can't say for every publishing company. Bart, is yours in italics?
It is. The second was, but it's very unnoticeable.
Yours, yeah, so somebody might put a note in the margin or something, but generally speaking, they're going to still have it in italics now. Is yours in italics, Karen?
It is.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, that's where we're getting that process, right? So that those four things, three things that can count, three things that we just talked about are told to us by this account from 1618, retrospective account, and they're not necessarily stated in the original rules. Okay? Now look at the rules explained. We've got about half an hour to do this, so we should be good. So over the years, historians have offered varying degrees of summative and or explanatory commentary upon the rules set forth by Bishop Bancroft. For our purposes in this lesson, we will look at the comments offered by three of the more recent scholarly works on this topic. Number one, Manifold Greatness, The Making of the King James Bible, edited by Helen Moore and Julian Reed. Number two, Bible, The Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011 by Gordon Campbell. And the King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndale to Today by David Norton. All three of these books were written in 2011 in commemoration of the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. Writing on behalf of the Bodleian Library, Helen Moore and Julian Reed offer the following general commentary on on Bancroft's rules and Manifold Greatness, The Making of the King James Bible. These authors break their comments up into three different categories. Quote, the rules address three main issues: the use of earlier translations of the Bible, the appearance of language of the new translation, and the organization of the company's work. In the first category, it was laid down that the translator should follow the text of the bishop's Bible, 1586, whenever possible. And then I have a bracket here. This statement is somewhat confused. It was the 1602 edition of the bishop's Bible that serves as the base text, not the original 1568. That's an important point, because if you go look at a 1568 and you go look at a 1602, there are differences between them, and the base text was not the 1568, it was the 1602. Okay? Anyway, substituting, so let me read that again without my bracket. Okay? It was laid down that the translator should follow the text of the bishop's Bible of 1568, I'm saying 1602, whenever possible, substituting the words of another translation, such as Coverdale or Geneva, where it was deemed, quote, to agree better with the text, i.e., the original Hebrew and Greek, than the bishop's Bible. The established chapter divisions as employed in English from the Wycliffe Bible onwards were to be retained, but there were to be none of the contentious and discursive marginal notes typical of the Geneva Bible that were so disliked by the king. So far as the language was concerned, the rule specified that the new translation should retain the familiar English forms of biblical names and the old ecclesiastical words such as church rather than congregation. This rule intended to remove the translation as far as possible from the arena of Puritan controversy. In terms of organization, the rules laid down that individual members of the company should work on the allotted text and then confirm and reached collective agreement. The rule stipulated that the agreed text was then to have been circulated for comment to the other companies, who were to send any comment and alteration with reason back to the originating committee. Experts differ on whether such cross-company consultation actually took place. In addition, four particular points of connection, the judgment of any learned man in the land could be sought, and the opinion of clearly deemed sufficiently learned men were to be canvassed by the bishops. The final state of the translation was the general meaning. at which any outstanding differences of opinion were to be resolved. The demands of the undertaking at a logistical and administrative level, let alone an intellectual one, were astonishing for an age in which Oxford and Cambridge were even separated from London by 2 days riding on horseback. And we don't think about a lot of this stuff today, right? Today you hop in the car, you can drive from London to Cambridge in, I don't know exactly, a couple hours, I'm assuming. It's a day's drive probably between those two areas, right? But all this is supposed to be done, and all this inner company work and all this stuff in a day when it takes 2 days to ride from one place to the other on horseback. So what Moore and Reed are saying here is that, is this a very regimented, very sort of lofty, set forth premise of how this is going to be done? Page 6. Gordon Campbell, author of Bible, The Story of the King James Bible, utilizes a different format for commenting on each rule individually. Immediately after quoting it, rather than retyping each rule, I have noted in brackets which rule a given comment is related to. So I didn't retype all these rules again. I'm just telling you which one he's commenting on. So let's look at number one. Number one was, again, the thing about the bishop's Bible. Here's what Campbell said. This rule specified the version of the Bible that was to be a revision of the bishop's Bible for which the 1602 edition was used, rather than a fresh translation from ancient languages. As the revisers say in the preface to the King James Version, the translators to the reader, their purpose was not to make a new translation, but to make a good one better. Okay? Number two. Again, that's about the names and the spellings. The term vulgarly does not have its modern sense of coarsely, but specified a preference for the English form of names over the Hebrew and Greek forms. This, as will be shown below, is the rule that was most often transgressed. So in other words, this was not followed with any uniformity. Rule 3, about the old ecclesiastical words. The implementation of this rule was to be a persistent source of Puritan, should say, objections to the King James Version, as Puritans appropriating Tyndale's argument preferred congregation to church, wash to baptize, elder or senior to bishop, and minister to priest. Now, we've already talked about that when we went through Tyndale's translation, right? I showed you how Tyndale intentionally changed these words so as to distance his translation from Roman Catholicism. Now, Rule 3 is they're going to say you've got to retain all of those ecclesiastical terms. Okay? So this is going to make the Puritans upset that rule is going to be there. Rule 4. Diverse signification of names means more than one meaning, and propriety of places means the context in which, should say, the word, not world, in which the word is used. The assertion of the authority of the church fathers, ancient fathers, and the need to conform to the doctrine of the church, which is when they mean analogy of faith, were anti-Puritan rules, because Puritans tended to believe that the church, should say fathers, had no authority, and that doctrine should spring from the Bible, not the other way around. So folks, look, when you look at the rules here, the rules are devised by Bancroft, who is the arch enemy of the Puritan movement. When you study the rules, are the rules structured in such a way so as to disfavor the Puritans? Okay? That's just a fact. And we gotta come to terms with this fact. Rule 5. By this time, division of chapter into verses had become embedded because of verse references were an aid to memory. Hebrew and Greek manuscripts have been divided in various ways since late antiquity, but the system adopted by the King James revisers had been introduced by French publisher Robert Erskine, who divided chapters into verses, and a series of Bibles in Greek and Latin published in Geneva. These divisions had first appeared in an English Bible in the Geneva Bible of 1560, and had since become established. So in other words, were they going to follow all those normal divisions? Rule 6. Rule 6 is related to the marginal notes. The interdiction against expository marginal notes may have originated in King James's dislike of the anti-monarchical notes in the Geneva Bible, but also reflected unease about the prospect that marginal notes might reflect a particular theological perspective. Rule 7 is about cross-references to other places and verses. This rule gave the authority for the revisers to produce a system of cross-references. And again, if I just click back to this, that's what you see right here in the margin. This is just cross-references. This isn't commentary, this isn't explanation, it's just cross-references. Okay? Where am I at? 8? Alright. Rules 8, 9, and 10, and 11. 8, 9, 10, and 11. The phrase, by authority, probably means by authority of the Synod of Bishops, rather than by the king's authority, but in either case would have the force of law, which meant that those in receipt of inquiries were commanded rather than asked to give an opinion. So if they wrote me and said, Bishop Ross, what say ye about X verse? I could not probably ignore it. I would be obligated to what? Respond. Okay? Rules 12 and 13. King's professors, more commonly known as Regis professors. Now here, this is important. I've referenced this twice before. Here's where we're going to get the details. King's professors, more commonly known as Regis professors, are nominated by the crown. They had originated as acts of royal benefits at the time of the Reformation when Henry VIII had funded the original Regis professorships. But by the early 17th century, they had become important mechanisms by which the crown exercised authority in the universities. The Dean of Westminster was the dawningly learned Lancelot Andrews, and the Dean of Chester was William Barlow, the official historian of the Hampton Court Conference. The Regius professors of Hebrew, Edward Lively at Cambridge and John Harding at Oxford, and Greek, Andrew Downs at Cambridge and John Perney at Oxford, all of whom are discussed in the next chapter, did not all go on to play an important role in the translation. Indeed, Lively died before it began, but they were not appointed simply for their personal qualities. They had all been appointed to their chair by the monarch, so were expected to keep the king's wishes in mind as they directed the translators. This is a highly important point that most people miss, okay? The very selection of the deans and the professors were those who had been appointed to these positions by royal authority. So are they entrusted then to some degree to make sure that the king's wishes are followed through with this Bible? Okay? And then Rule 14, which church's Bible was the common name for the Great Bible, so-called from one of its printers, Edward Whitchurch. So if you go to Rule 14 again, that's the one that says which other Bibles they're supposed to use if they think they agree better with the original than the bishops. So Tyndale's, Matthew's, Coverdale's, Whitchurch's is the Geneva, it's the Great Bible. It's called Whitchurch's because one of the publishers was Edward Whitchurch. So some people just refer to it as Whitchurch's Bible and the Geneva. Okay? Campbell also includes a note regarding Rule 15. That was added later at the behest of the Vice Chancellor of Cambridge. See comments above for more information. Regarding the thorough nature of these rules, Campbell offers the following statement in summation, quote, these rules were quite unprecedented in their rigor. Whereas previous translations had been the work of a small number of individuals or a group of slapdash bishops, the King James was a carefully mediated enterprise in which panels of translators worked collaboratively. So think about these other Bibles. Tyndale, who did it? Basically Tyndale by himself. Coverdale, who did it? Pretty much Coverdale by himself. Whitchurch, was Coverdale using the work of others? Geneva was done by a small collection of Genevan exiles at Geneva, right? And then the Bishop's Bible was done by about 8 different bishops of the Anglican Church. So this is going to be a highly regimented group, mediated enterprise in which panels of translators work collaboratively, according to Campbell. Now, I think we have time to finish. David Norton's commentary on the rules given to the translators by Bancroft is like the one followed by Campbell. Norton groups rules together and comments on a chunk of three or more at a time. His analysis begins by combining rules 1 and 14, upon which he offers the following explanation. Well, why would you comment on rules 1 and 14 together? Because both of those rules are dealing with what they're supposed to use as their base text for the revision here, okay? So here's what Norton says, quote, it was a revision of its official predecessor, which was the bishops. And the words were to be minimalist, the only criterion for changing being the truth of the original. So they're to follow the bishop's Bible unless the original would say that the bishop's was what?
Wrong.
Or not adequately translated in some manner. Okay? So again, I can't stress this enough. Are they starting with a blank page and a Hebrew and Greek manuscript and then starting to write out in English? Is that what they're doing? No, they're starting with a base text. The base text is the bishop's text. The bishop's was the official Bible of the Anglican Church. They're using the 1602 edition, and they're not supposed to change it unless what? Unless the truth of the original would say otherwise, right? So it is to be a minimally revised revision of the bishop's Bible, only changing things that would not cohere with the quote truth of the original. There's no suggestion that the translator should revise for style. Okay? Now I'm not saying that he didn't do that, but it's not in the rules. Okay? There's no suggestion that the translator should revise for style. Two significant features of Rule 14 are the idea that the translator should pick and choose between, should say, readings in their predecessors. From Tyndale through Coverdale, the Great Bible, Edward Whitchurch and Richard Grafton was printed, was the printer, of the first Great Bible, to Geneva. And the omission of the Reims, implicitly, it is forbidden, but not actually. So if you look at Rule 14, is the same thing about the Reims?
No.
But do we know from previous studies that the Reims was used? We do know that, okay? Again, that's an inconvenient truth for some, but it's a fact that we can't ignore. There's one major omission from the rules here. No mention is made of text to be translated from. The preface reply to the question of text is simplistic. Quote, if you ask what they had before this truly, it was the Hebrew text of the Old Testament and Greek of the New. These are the two golden pipes, or rather conduits, wherethrough the olive branches empty themselves into gold. That's what they said in the preface. Okay? So do the rules say more about what they're supposed to follow in English than they do about what Greek or Hebrew they're supposed to be looking at? Okay? Next, Norton discusses three rules that deal with translation practice, i.e. rules 2, 3, and 4. Quote, the first of these, to use the commonly known form of names and implicitly to use them consistently, was poorly adhered to. The translators paid more attention to the form used in the originals and did not establish uniformity either of sound or spelling. Isaiah, for instance, is also Esi in 2 Kings 19:2, Isaiah in the New Testament, and Esai in the Apocrypha. Only some of this variety comes from differences between Hebrew and Greek spelling. The concern to keep, quote, old ecclesiastical words is anti-Puritan. It harkens back to Moore's attacks on the tendentiousness of some of Tyndale's vocabulary. Here, congregation instead of church, or say elder instead of priest, would have had strong anti-establishment implications. Rule 4 underlines the desire to preserve traditional understanding. These things are in keeping with James's respect for the established, quote, rather a church with some faults than an innovation, he had declared at Hampton Court. So was James content to retain most of this high churchism in this Bible? Okay. Excuse me. Regarding rules 5 through 7, Norton writes, quote, "Next come some more general matters, of which the restriction on marginal notes is by far the most important, for it places attention most exclusively on the text itself." He then quotes rules 4, 5, and 6, which I didn't do because they're already in your notes above. The report of the Synod of Dort summarizes rules 6 and 7 and then elaborates on the use of the margin. Quote. Should have a quotation mark before secondly. Secondly, no notes were to be placed in the margin, but only parallel passages to be noted. Thirdly, where a Hebrew and Greek word admits two meanings of subtle kind, the one was to be expressed in the text and the other in the margin. The same to be done where different readings, where different reading was found in good copies. And fourth, the more difficult Hebraisms and Greecisms were consigned to the margin. So those are further elaborations on rule, that would be rule 6 and 7. And then again, guys, if you look at this 1611, that's exactly what you're going to find. Okay, so look here. So here's Genesis 1 verse 11. You see this
cross, I don't know what you would call this, it's not a cross, but this mark, it directs you to go to the Hebrew, and then the Hebrew, it offers a alternative Hebrew reading, exactly like that rule, that explanation says. Okay?
Lastly, Norton summarizes rules 8 through 13 as follows. Quote, "The remainder of the original rules deal mostly with organization. An elaborate system for avoiding individualism, errors, or partisan translation is set out. All in a company were to draft a translation, then debate it among themselves. Then they were to be what would now be called peer review, circulating the draft to all the other companies before final review at a general meeting. Extending the desire to get collective wisdom, there's a particular care to draw on the wisdom of the whole country, though there is no record of scholars outside the committee contributing particular observations." So we have these rules talking about it being sent to all the learned men of the land, yet we have no extant survivable documentation of when or how they might have had input into the process. So we just, the rule says it, but we can't know for sure whether or not it was actually what? Done in that sense. Okay? So, in the next lesson we will discuss to what extent these rules were followed, as well as look at the various translational companies that were established along with their specific assignments. Okay? Alright, so we got a few minutes if anybody has any questions. So this lesson, guys, is a pretty detailed presentation here of the rules that were set forth by Bancroft. And again, just in summation here, is this project being established by a high church Anglican Bancroft? Are the rules partial to the Anglicans?
Yes.
Their Bible is going to be the base text. The rules set forth there are going to favor their vocabulary and their traditions by mentioning the church fathers and other things that the Puritans are just sort of out of luck on. So I don't think this Bible, even though Reynolds is going to participate in the project, it's definitely probably not what he originally conceived when he floated the idea for there to be a new what? A new Bible. Okay. And again, all this is more reasons why I think when he said, would it please the king that there be a new Bible at Hampton Court in January 1604, that when he said that, his main objection was not for a new Bible, it was for the king to sanction the use of what? The Geneva Bible in the church. Okay. All right. So we got a few minutes if anybody has any questions or comments.
Can you say why King James was so biased against the Puritans?
Because he viewed them as a threat to his authority.
Okay. So that teacher that he had when he was growing up that read the Bible to him all the time, was he a Puritan?
He was more of a Protestant, more of a, in Scotland he would have been more Presbyterian.
Okay.
And James reacts pretty hard against that, in favor of the establishment. Now think about it. After Henry VIII, who was the head of the Anglican Church? Not the Pope, but who? The King of England. Under his daughter Elizabeth, she was the head of the church. Now James is going to succeed Elizabeth, and he's succeeding as head of the Anglican Church. Do you think knowing his political philosophy, he's going to be like, oh, wait a minute, time out. This is no good.
This goes against the Bible. We need to change this. We need further reform. The obvious answer to that is that's not what he did. Because is he having basically ultimate authority served up to him on a platter?
He is. He already believes in divine right. He's now head of the church. He appoints professors and chancellors and so on and so forth that are largely have their position in the universities by royal sanction and approval. And it's all designed to make sure that to the extent they were able that all this stuff happened the way that he wanted it to. Okay? So, those are the historical facts of what happened. And you see that even more clearly when you look at the rules that were drafted and who drafted them and why they were drafted. Okay? Any other questions? Mike?
One reason that James didn't like the Puritans, he didn't like the Bible that they used because the footnotes challenged the king's authority.
Yep, that's the other big reason, for sure. He did not like we've talked about this many times, he calls them seditious notes. So, all right, any other questions or comments? Now, next Sunday what we're going to do is we're going to look at to what extent these rules were followed. And we're going to look at a few different categories of examples to try to figure out to what extent they actually followed these rules and to what extent there has been good understanding of these rules by pro-King James advocates in the past. But anyway, if there's no questions, we're done. I'm going to shut down the stream. I want to thank those of you for joining who have done so. And if you have any questions, you can stick around and ask them after the fact.